Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest episode of Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Tess Gerritsen, and we're going to be talking about her latest thriller, The Spy Coast. We're conducting this interview before our book reporter review comes in, so I'm going to share praise from a couple other places. Kirkus gave it a starred review and said expect mystery, action, and bloodshed, and this exciting thriller launched straight from the peaceful shores of Maine. And another starred review from Booklist: compelling reading throughout with astute characterizations. Readers of Richard Osman's Thursday Murder Club mysteries will love this. It's a Book Reporter Bets On selection, and I think this is Tess's best book to date. I am telling you, folks, I love this. And that's saying something because I loved her Rizzoli and Isle series. So with that intro, welcome, Tess. So great to have you here.
Oh, it's so great to see you again, Carol. We go way back. So
we go way back. Man, like, I think the first Rizzoli and Isles book, like, we're way back, you know, pre that. You know, I heard you talk about this book at the U.S. Book Show, and I love the interview that you did there. And I love where the idea of it came from. So let's start by you sharing that with our readers, because it's such a good story.
Yeah, it's a quirky little thing about my home state. I moved to Maine 33 years ago, and my husband, who's a doctor, opened up a medical practice. And part of bringing in new patients is you want to find out more about them. So he would do occupational histories, and he would get this answer: I used to work for the government, but I can't talk about it. And after a couple of times, my husband came home and he goes, what is with this town we've moved to? Who are these people? So a real estate agent told us they're all retired CIA. And then I became much more, observant, and found out that two of my neighbors on my street were retired spies. I found out that the parents of one of my son's friends were married spies, and a lot of them have just come to move to Maine. And so it gave me a little, I guess, more curiosity about who these people are that I run into at the post office. It's a small town. We have a lot of gray-haired people here. And I just started thinking, what were their lives like before they retired? What did they do? And that just seemed like a book.
Oh, it just sounds so great. But I could picture you in the supermarket going, how is she touching the carrots? How is she touching this? What's in her cart? Why is it in her cart? You know?
Yes.
It sounds like a completely different thing. Did you interview any of these people for just some general thoughts on the subject, or are they really like closed mouth?
I did not interview them, but I know who some of them are. And I also have, I know who some of them are sometimes through their children. Or their grandchildren who have told me, oh yeah, dad was a spy. You know, a lot of the families already know what dad did or what mom did. So I thought that the one way I could get people maybe to tell me the truth is to look at their memoirs. Mm-hmm. So I read a lot of CIA memoirs. And you get a sense more of what their lives are like overseas, what it is to be a spy every day. And for the most part, it's just a job. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is just really getting into the, you know, beneath the people's brains and figuring out what it is they know. It's not running around with guns like James Bond. It's making friends and cultivating friendships and using the information that you find out.
Yeah. My one friend, Chris Wickham, was on the hostage rescue team. And I said, what's it like? Because I'm thinking swooping in a lot. He goes, no, it's a lot of lying in wet fields with a gun, trying to figure out what's going on. It's a lot less like, you know, let's go in and do this. It's a lot more waiting than you think. And it's a lot more, you don't know what you're going to do next. You know, Ben says this great line: if we can't trust each other, how can we trust? And Maggie retorts, that's a pretty thing to say, Ben, but you know better. We all do. We shouldn't trust each other. We can't afford to, not in our business, and I don't even trust myself. And I was thinking, what must it like to go through life like that, that you don't know who is going to be doing what to you? And that was such a great one. I pulled that out. Tell us about, like, you know, what you're thinking about these people.
That is precisely what I was trying to get out of, you know, with this story, is it's not just about the gunplay or the spy story or the mystery. It's really about what kind of a personality goes into this work and what does it do to your life? Mm-hmm. A imagine that every friendship you make, there's a sense of maybe there's a payback here. Maybe there's a reason this person is trying to be my friend rather than they like me. And also it's the question of, do you trust your spouse? I mean, what does that do to your marriage? Right. How did you meet this person? How do you know that they really fell in love with you and not what you do? So I think it was the psyche of espionage that was most fascinating to me. And I wanted to explore that because that's what Maggie has to figure out for herself. She has to decide whether she trusts this man she loves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as she meets him, she's trying to figure out, wait, was he there for a reason? Like, he walked into this market. Was he watching me in advance and set up to meet me? Was he following me before? And you lay in bed with this person and you're not sure. Are they there to get me? Are they there to stop me from doing something? It's got to really be this psyche kind of crazy thing that you're living with every day.
Yeah. And I think it's got to be very hard. First of all, I would be a terrible spy. I can tell you right there. I would be an awful spy because I would just tell you the truth. And also to have this relationship with the truth that is not necessarily real. I mean, what you say, you may know you're lying. How do you do that? How do you become a convincing liar? And yet this is something they have to do all the time.
Yeah. All the time. They just walk in with that blank face and this is what's going to happen. I also love the name of the town is Purity. And I felt that was a real play on words. It's like, this is a town that everything is very pure was in my head. And then I'm like, it's anything but. So where did the name of the town come from?
Well, I wanted to give it the sense of innocence because, you know, I think for a lot of people, except for the terrible events of last week that happened and you know, the shooting in Lewiston, most people in the country think of Maine as a pure and innocent place. And for the most part, I feel it is. It's like the biggest neighborhood. The whole state is one big neighborhood. We know each other. You'll run into the governor dumping her trash at the local recycling center. And that was what I was trying to reflect, was that this is a very innocent place. And yet, even in an innocent place, bad things can wash up on your shore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or at the end of your driveway.
Yeah.
How much research did you have to be doing on what happens at a chicken farm? And I definitely want blue eggs. One of the girls in my book group brought us eggs the other day and somebody got a blue one. I was like, oh, I want the blue egg. It's my favorite color.
Well, everybody says, how do you know about chickens? Well, I know about chickens because my son used to have 70 chickens. again, he had these visions of being a poultry farmer. So I would help out. When he went on vacation one January, I was there feeding and watering the chickens every morning in below 15 degree temperatures. And yes, there are blue eggs from a certain type of chicken. So I really came to love chickens and dislike roosters intensely.
No roosters in the hen house. No roosters in the hen house. I'm just thinking as I was reading this, I was like, wait, she has way too much knowledge. Like, this is hands-on knowledge. So now I know where it came from. I've got it. And what about the name, the Martini Club? It could have been the Scotch Club, the Bourbon Club. Why martinis? Because it just sounds fun.
Yeah, you know what? I used to belong to a book group that involved martinis. And it turns out that I love martinis. And the martini that Maggie drinks, that's actually my martini. So that it just came out. It fell out. You know, I don't plan these things. And it's a spur of the moment thing. It's a little bit like when Joe asks you, what's the name of your book group? And Maggie just pulls it out of thin air. That's how it came. It came out of thin air.
Out of thin air. Well, I think that your recipe for your martini should be on your website. I think this has got to be there so we all know, like, you know, what to do. And they also indulge in some aged spirits, which are hoarded and sipped. And I really like that. Like, who's going to drink the last inch? Who figured out? And it's the Longmorn, like, what, as an example. And I just love that because I could just picture them sitting, drinking, but they all have their own memories of what's going on. They all have their own past about what gig they did that they really haven't told each other of what's going on. So just picture sitting in that room and reminiscing, but not talking. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. And the whiskey aspect of it is another thing that I feel like I have deep knowledge of. Because I have
husband, you have to come hang out here. You know,
I have sipped that Longmorn, and it was a 30-year, and it was like, oh my gosh, this is like, I can't believe I'm drinking something so delicious.
Right.
So yeah, when my spies drink a concoction, it's usually something that I've tried sometime in my life. But you're right. When you're of a certain age, and I'm of that certain age, you're looking back a lot. You're thinking about the things you did, that you're proud of, the things that you're not proud of, things that you will not tell your friends about. And that's what I imagine them sitting around a fire, maybe hinting at an operation that went wrong or the operation that went right, but never really indulging in truth telling, because sometimes it's too painful.
Yeah. You don't want to look back. You want to just be able to say, we retired, we're not doing this anymore. And I love that they've got this book club, and yet they said they don't often read the book. Like sometimes it's like, this is the book we're in. And they bring the, like, I'm bringing goat curry and I'm bringing this. So the meals that they're bringing are these elaborate. And I just feel like they need this sense of community with people who understand who they are. So it's not about the book, though it was interesting to see what they were reading. It's more like, we just have an excuse to then get together and hang out and talk. Am I right?
Yeah. And then they bring, of course, their international background. So, you know, anybody who's lived overseas for a certain amount of time has picked up recipes that you're not going to get here. And it is true. I think I have a line there that says chili addiction is a real thing. Yes. And it is. Yes. So once you've gotten addicted to chilies, it's like, you've got to put chilies in everything. Yes. So here they are looking up finding sources for Sichuan peppers. And that is what I can surely see from anybody who's lived abroad. And these people certainly have.
Yeah. And you know, when you get the pension for something, it's Halloween today as we're recording this, and we always have chili on Halloween, which was like something we started with the kids. Well, my husband goes, what's for dinner tonight? I said, it's chili with a lot of chipotle chili in it. I said, that's the only way we make this right. And it's not the recipe, but you're right. If you've got the spice or something that becomes you because you've had it another place, that's got to be part of the menu. And I feel like they're all bringing things that they've tried. I mean, I love the opening scene where she's walking around and she gets the soup, or it's one of the opening scenes, and she has the soup and she's eating the soup. And it's just a little thing, but you feel like you're eating it with her. And when Danny comes over and he's eating the soup as well, you feel like there's this instant connection of you being in that place. And I feel like you got us in each of the places where they went. That's what I felt like I was there. I felt like I was there with the cuisine or whatever.
Well, that's great. I mean, I have been to all these places that I write about in the story. And I think it would be really hard to write about Bangkok and Istanbul if you haven't been to those places and smelled the smells of the local mm-hmm. market. So I wanted to bring that sense of international sophistication to the pages.
Yes. And that's exactly what each of these people have, because you've got to fit in each of these places. You've got to know the customs, what you do and don't do. And the book takes us from Bangkok to Istanbul, to London, to Malta. And you can tell that you've been there. You can tell just by your writing about the streets and what people are seeing, and even the way they're hiding and ducking down the corners. You've got to know that that city has that kind of streets. That's not going to happen in New York. New York is not this, like, you're going to be on an avenue for a very long time and then have to go try and hide. So you were picturing the places just by your descriptions of how they were hiding and how they were trying to get away in each of the situations.
So. Yeah, well, and it was fun kind of going back in memory lane and remembering all these places. Yeah.
And now we've got this poor woman. She's the Purity acting police chief, Zhou. And she has to deal with the challenges of Maggie and her friends. So this woman has just been named the acting police chief, and she is trying her best to solve every single thing that comes her way. And then she gets thwarted by the quartet, as I call them. So let's talk about her.
Jo Thibodeau, which is a very main name, you know, for this French Canadian kind of name. She is a multi-generational Mainer. She's her grandparents were probably born in Maine. She is a solid figure, and she reminds me of a lot of people I've met here who have been here for generations. They know their communities, they know their people, they know what's going on behind closed doors, they know who's a troublemaker. So she's the perfect cop for this little town, and she is determined to keep it safe. Mm-hmm. Now this dead body shows up on this on Maggie Bird's driveway, and Joe's got to figure out what's going on, and it flummoxes her every step of the way that these Martini Club people who are retirees from away seem to know a lot more than she does. They are quicker to crime scenes. They figure things out sooner. And she's thinking, who are these people? And the conflict, I think, is not only between outsiders and people who live here. It's also about generations. Mm-hmm. Jo is in her 30s. These people are in their 60s and 70s. It almost feels as if the arrogance of youth blinds them to the abilities of older people. Mm-hmm. She thinks She's the cop. She should be doing this thing, you know, figuring out this crime. And yet these old people are ahead of her. Mm-hmm. I think it's that slow sense of respect that she develops over the course of the book to realize that, yeah, they're old, but they really have it all over me.
They've completely figured the whole thing out, folks. You know? And I love that when they go into her house and she says she has a security camera where most people would have like a ring light, and she's got this very elaborate security system. And they're like, is somebody going to get the chickens? Like, is that why you've got this? And it's so great because you're only in your frame of mind. Jo is just in her frame of mind as she's walking around. The other policemen are just in their frame of mind. And they're like, all the security, like what's going on? You know, the chickens.
There's 12 cameras on everything, right? And the infrared. And who is this woman who lives here? Yeah.
And they want to see everything on the camera. And she goes, well, I left at 6:30 so we can go forward from there. But she doesn't want them to see anything else they might be seeing. Like, let's get them to that point forward, which she hasn't seen as well. I really loved it. Really, really loved it. So then she falls for Danny, who's such a great character. And throughout the book, we don't know whether he's involved. Is he another agent? What is he? It's really this going back and forth. And you have this measured way of setting up the two of them together. Was that what you were like really thinking when you're writing, going, let's have this little bit of doubt going back and forth between them?
Well, the doubt is there because I didn't know.
Okay. I was going to get to that. Okay.
I mean, I'm writing this. I'm going, is Danny good? Is Danny bad? I'm not sure. I just know he's kind of a, you know, he's a wonderful man. He seems like he's a wonderful man. So until the resolution of that question, I did not know. And I did not know what was going to happen to their marriage. And I think that the resolution was kind of a shock to me as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was when I saw that, I was like, wow, that was not what I was expecting at all. So what I'm thinking is, we've got these characters, they've all been to these assorted places, typically on different missions, but they have these skill sets that when brought together, make them very powerful. Like they walk into a room and it's like I have a set of skills that not many other people have. And I think when you were working on their backgrounds, were you thinking about future books? Because this is going to be the Martini Club series, I take it, going forward. So were you thinking, I have to lay some groundwork now of who they are, because in the next book, they can't be something else. Or are there different people in the next book?
Well, first of all, I didn't know it was going to be a series. To me, this was a one-off. This was like, you know, but then I get to the end of the book and I thought, oh, I'm going to miss them. I don't want to leave Purity, Maine. I don't want to leave Jo Thibodeau behind. And so I was not thinking about continuing them for another book. I think they just kind of define themselves. Mm-hmm. I knew who Maggie was. I mean, but these others, like the married couple, they were so much fun. There's a, you know, he was not in the field. He was just sat at a desk in the CIA, but his wife is the smart one. Mm-hmm. And that combination of he really respects her. He thinks she's the smart one in the family. He tries to be the good house husband to take care of things.
I'm going to take care of things. Not a problem.
Right. And then the other two gentlemen, one of, you know, because being in academics is a big cover for non-official agents abroad. I had to have an academic in there. And I love that sense that he's a history professor. So he also knows a lot about the history of the places he's going to. And then finally, there's Ben, who's kind of the, I guess you'd say almost the mobster type of guy who would be the heavy man whenever you need something. So they kind of define themselves. And I love the way that they interact. I mean, whenever there's a need for somebody to find something out on the internet, they all look at Ingrid because they know she's the one who knows how to use the computer the best.
She's going to get in there quickly, but they all have their roles. They all know, like, you know, I'm going to bring this. And there's also a little bit of romantic tension within the group that Maggie's ignored for years. And, you know, she's the main character here. Are there others that are going to be in the spotlight later on? Like, are you going to, or is she the main character for the next book?
She and Jo are going to be continuing as the main characters. I'm not planning on bringing any new active spies into the next episode. But the next book is really much more focused on the town of Purity and a crime that happens there. But again, we have that wonderful interaction between young Jo, who's now finally going to become chief of police officially, and our five martini club people.
It's like, and then she's going to sit there and say something's going on, and she's just going to call them like, let me just bring you guys in. Let's just stop with the game. You obviously know what you're doing. Don't tell me what's going on, you know? And you leave the door open for lots of characters in future books. Like, you leave the door open of who can come in that comes and visits, who was a former spy, or family members coming home and what they knew and not. Do you, have you made notes about those ideas, or is it like, oh, Carol, come on. You know, like, I don't know everything of where I'm going on this, you know?
Well, the second book, I'm working on the second draft now, so I pretty much know how that one works. If there is a third book, and I assume there will be a third book, I am going to be using a very, it's peculiar, another peculiar thing about my town. Is that we have an annual conference here. I mean, we only have 5,000 people who live here. We have an annual conference that has to do with international affairs. And they bring in diplomats and leaders and politicians from around the world to descend on this little town in the middle of winter to come and give a talk. Wow. And it's open to the public. And I always wondered, how did they get these people? Because these are names that we see on the television all the time. They come to this little town in Maine to talk. It just occurred to me that that's a great setting for something to go terribly wrong.
Oh, perfect. Absolutely perfect. You can sit there and think, you can sit in the audience next time and go, what could happen here? What could we do here? You know, something's going to happen. You know, let me sit in this room. So do you outline in advance, which I'm not sure you do because you didn't know how it was going to end. Do you do any outlining in advance or just sit down and write?
I don't do any outlining. I've tried it. I wish I could. Mm-hmm. But every time I try to write an outline, I'd always end up just tossing it away because things go off in their own direction. I think that probably I'm more driven forward by the characters and what they're telling me, mm-hmm. What seems to happen on the spur of the moment is very often when the twist happens. Mm-hmm. And those odd little twists occur just out of the blue. I mean, I don't plan them ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So it's not a good way to write a book. It's very frustrating because I end up writing myself into blind alleys and then I'm stuck. But as one person told me, it's when you're in that blind alley and you're stuck that the really brilliant idea comes. Yeah. So maybe it's a good thing that I do it this way.
Yeah, it's like if you get her down a street and she's got to get out, and you don't know what to do. You've got to either be clever or fast. There's one or the other. It's going to be clever or fast, and or both.
Or you back up and think, how did I get here? Maybe I should have taken a left turn instead, and that draws your plot in a different direction. So it's a fun way to write. It's a frustrating way to write, and I think that if I'm surprised, then readers are surprised as well.
Yeah, definitely. And there are so many scenes that are, you know, and I don't want to give anything away, but she drops somebody off someplace and something happens and then something else happens. And it's all these things that she would never think that was going to be happening in that situation. And if that person didn't go to that place, but everybody knew that he would, it never would have happened. But where you also are looking at when people are doing this, they're looking at a bigger picture. They're looking at the family. They're looking beyond just the person and saying, how can I wreak havoc on this? And they're getting to know enough to be able to move the needle, whichever way they've got to do it. And I find that it's, you've got to be incredibly smart to be sitting there and getting yourself out of some of these situations. And I like that you wrote older, smart characters as opposed to, oh my gosh, they've got gray hair and they don't know how to do anything anymore. No, these people are super clever.
There's such an advantage to being an old spy because you aren't noticed. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point, is you don't want to be noticed. My husband, he always likes to call himself the gray man because he says he will show up at a party and nobody will remember that they'd met him the night before. So, and it's really true that we notice the pretty, the handsome people. We go to a party and those are the faces that we remember, but we don't maybe remember the bald guy in the corner. Mm-hmm. So, and he's the one who's like taking notes. I do think that we should be making more use of this experience, or maybe that's why so many spies, when they choose disguises, the disguise is always that they make themselves older.
Yeah. It's like, what can I do? Because you don't want to look young going into the place. And it's true though. It's the person, like when you're in the room with them, their heads are going the whole time. And I think that you do a great job of writing the inner monologue of what they're doing. So we're with them every single step of the way of what's going on. It's not like they get to the end of the room and we see them plotting to get to the end of the room. And I think that's one of the things I really loved about the book, because I felt like I was traveling with the characters, especially with Maggie as she was moving around and feeling all her emotions. You did such a good job of, you know, what would really happen in that situation? How would you feel? So, yeah. Oh my gosh, this is like so good. Did you know how you're going to rap before you began, or obviously not?
No, I didn't. I didn't know a lot. Let's put it that. I mean, to begin with, I didn't know if her marriage was real or not. That was the primary question for me. That was the big emotional question for me is, I love this man, but do I trust him? And you know, that's actually a trope that's been used again and again in spy novels. Do I love this man and is he bad? And I chose to maybe do the twist in the other direction than most spy novels do.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting too, because there's a scene at the beginning where he does something when they're out to dinner at this very expensive restaurant. And she knows exactly, like she's like his match on going in and solving what happens to happen with this person that's on the floor. And I found that so interesting because it's just like, well, I just like, you know, saw it on TV or something like that. I just knew what to do. I'd watch somebody do it. And I just found that she was really trying to keep this relationship working, that she really didn't want to give anything away of what was going on. And then where things go from there for him. And it's just,
yeah, I mean, isn't that funny that we would try to hide our expertise in something because she obviously knows what she's doing, but she has to pretend that she really doesn't, that she just lucked into it.
Right. You can't jump up on the plane. I watched that show Hijack a couple of weeks ago. And this one guy is a mediator. That's what he does. And it's so funny because when he's in that position, he sees the plane completely differently from everybody else. And it's like these people walking in the room. They have to foresee a room and still wonder where the exit is. I don't care how old they are. I think they've got to figure out, I've got to figure out a way out. Because you just don't know what's going to happen. If you have this many experiences of trauma, I mean, let's face it, what they go through is a lot of trauma. You've got to be not scarred in some way, but sort of like just have some kind of a skin on you of, I could get myself out if I have to. What am I going to do? Like, I know the door's there. I know.
Yeah, always looking for an exit. And that is so stressful. Can you imagine that? I mean, when you and I go into a restaurant, we just look for a nice table, maybe by the window, but we're not looking at it like, oh, I can get shot through that window. Let me get in the back instead. Right. Terrible, terrible stress.
There were a couple of restaurants like that in the 80s where the mob guys ate and you would worry about it. But usually the guys with the guns had really good shots. I mean, they were not, I've never heard of somebody else being taken out in a mob incident. They're always... But there were a couple of restaurants you could really worry yourself about. You can worry, you know, walking on the street behind them, you know. So the ending comes to you and you're sitting there writing. And then do you go back and start the rewriting process? Like you do, do you do one really rough draft and then go from there?
The first draft is really rough. I mean, it's a piece of what I'm doing, you know, it's terrible. It's awful. And that's when I'm usually the most depressed is when I finish the first draft and I look at it and think, I'll never fix this. I don't know what to do with this. It's all over the place. By the third draft, it's starting to look like a book. So I probably go through 6, 7, 8 drafts sometimes. And that is probably where my strength is I'm a great rewriter. I can take a terrible first draft and usually fix things.
And, you know, I think that people don't think about how many drafts you go through before the reader actually sees it and where some of the plot points were and it wasn't really working for your editor or somebody from the outside sat and saw something. Who sees your work first when you finish it? Who's the first read?
My husband. No, but and he doesn't see it until I feel it's ready to go to my agent. So he's the first read. He's very good at picking up, you know, like typos and misspellings. And I really want somebody to read it for logic. Does this make sense? You know, or are you moved by it? That's the real other thing is I really need people to feel some emotional attachment to these characters. Then after he reads it, then it goes to my agent and then she passes it on to editors.
Got it. So he's reading the book. Are you like circling the room, watching his face, trying to figure out what's going on? Do you send him away for a weekend and go, here, come back with your comments? Because it would be like shattering to me if you've run all this work and they sit there and goes, like this, you know, like this.
And well, you know what, I have to admit, I kind of see how many pages in he's gone. Like, how fast is he reading? Is he really reading slowly? Does that mean it's boring? I haven't yet had him say this is a piece of, you know, right, crap. Okay. He's either just said, you know, at the worst it'll go pretty good.
And then you don't make dinner for 3 days. Now, what's your work schedule like? Do you get up in the morning and start writing? Like, do you have a definitive time you write every day?
Oh, it's coffee and breakfast and a walk. And then I sit down and write. That's it. I mean, I'm pretty much a creature of habit. And I love being by myself in my room. It doesn't bother me to be solitary.
Right.
I'll try and write. I mean, my goal is 4 pages a day. Don't always reach it. But that'll get you a first draft within about 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're making dinner or you're out on a walk and you come up with an idea. Do you write it down someplace? Do you
make it? If it's a good idea, I will remember it. I don't need to write it down.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, sometimes if it's late at night and you wake up and you have an idea, then you have to, because you'll forget it by the morning. But I almost never get good ideas then. It's always, if I'm stuck, that's the issue. If I'm stuck and I need an idea, I have a couple of things I do. You know, take a walk. I think walks are good. Hot water, you know, take a bath. But driving is probably the number one place where I've solved my most difficult plot problems. Mm-hmm. Driving a really boring stretch of road with me at the wheel, nobody else in the car, just doing something else with your brain, because when your brain is engaged in a mundane task, it feels like the creative side is busy playing and figuring out what the answer is.
That's exactly. I used to love flights to California. Flights to California when there was no Wi-Fi and you could just sit there and think for the 5 hours you were flying out there. And there was one time I went out 3 times in 1 month, and it was one of my most productive months because I was thinking outside of what's due tomorrow. I was thinking big idea. And it's funny because it is when you have kids, they always say, just put them in the car next to you and they'll talk and tell you everything. And it's really true. I mean, if you just say, let's go for a drive, you hear things that you wouldn't hear across the dinner table. And I think it's just that moment of you're going to someplace, you're on a drive and your brain is kind of free to say, okay, what am I going to do? What am I going to say? And I think it's fascinating to me how people can get themselves into a corner with, or authors have told me this so many times, and then get themselves out and just say, wait, I think I've got it. I think I've got what I can do.
Yeah.
And it's almost like sometimes I'd like to take a book apart with somebody and say, okay, where did you get stuck here? Where was this? Where was that? And I think it'd be, if you're teaching a course in writing somewhere along the way, that would be the fun one to do, is here's where I got stuck. And here's where I got to from there. Because
I think what's interesting is to go through somebody's multiple drafts and see this is where you started, and then the next draft, something changed. And how did you get from this point to that point? It almost requires you to really be able to have access to all the multiple versions of this book that somebody has written.
Yeah. Just find it fascinating, because it's not just, I love to read a book. I love to think about how they got to the story, you know? So how did you get to the title of The Spy Coast? Because I love the title.
I give all credit to Gracie Doyle, my editor, because I think she was the one who came up with it. My original title was Spyville.
Okay.
And they said, this is too small. It feels like a small book. And we went through a couple, Spy Town. And then finally, it was the team at Amazon that just said Spy Coast was what they felt like a big book.
It feels like a big book. It feels like you could go a lot of places with it as well.
And everybody also gives it a sense of place too. Yeah.
It's what a coast looks like. Everybody knows. And then those footprints there, those little sinister footprints in the snow, like, where are they going? Towards those trees. Very scary. Very scary. The audio also has two narrators. Did you select the performers for your book, or were they?
I think I selected the primary female narrator. I don't think I've heard the other one. Is it?
I think there are two. Let me just see. Hold on a second. I've got it written down. It is, hold on a second. Hillary Huber and Brittany Presley.
I believe I heard Hillary Huber's voice. Yes.
Okay. It's going to be fun. It's going to be fun just to see her, how they portray the characters. As I was reading, I think this book would make a great show. And I was so glad that I was so clever. And I see that Amazon has already optioned it. Like, I did that by telepathy, for series development. Are you going to be involved? Are you involved in that at all?
No, I'm not. And you know, it's this was actually part of the original offer from Amazon, is that publication plus Amazon Studios development.
Wow.
Yeah, which was one of another, you know, carrot that drew me over there. And I thought, wow, you know, getting all this plus the support of this fantastic editorial team. So we'll see. Options are always iffy. We just never know when it will go into actual development, but we have to wait also for the Screen Actors Guild strike to end.
Yes, we're close, because deals are happening these days, because we can at least do writers and producers. Like we're making progress. Boy, the strike is going on forever. They said we'll be solved on Halloween. Is it like trick or treat? You know, who knows? Who knows what's going on? But no, as you're reading it, and I'm going to be anxious to see what readers feel the same way. You see it. You see you've written so vividly, and you can tell you've been to the places, because there are little nuances in there, but it makes it so much fun. And then they can build, like, you know, Istanbul in LA. They can figure out how to
Right. Or why not go to Istanbul?
Why not? Why not do that? You know, Rizzoli and Isles was a very successful series that ran for 7 seasons. I looked up this morning. I was like, whoa, 7. Were you involved in that production at all? Or was that, were you like on set at all or anything?
Well, I visited the set twice, and then I was on the show once. But no, it was all up to the showrunners. And, but they were, you know, they welcomed me into the writer's room. I just told them that I had book deadlines to make, so I really couldn't help them break story. And they, the only things that they used really directly from me was the pilot episode, which was based on The Apprentice. And then there was one episode that was based on my short story. But everything else they came up with.
They came up from there. Well, here I think they've got a great, like, a roadmap. I mean, there's a great roadmap right here in this book about what to do. So what's next for the Martini Club? When's the next book? I know you're writing now. Is this next year?
It has a pub date projected of April 2025.
Okay, great.
Yes. So I have a lot of time to, you know, to polish, because I'm only on the second draft.
Well, you know what else too, though? You can hear the feedback on this one, and you hear what people are excited about. And of course, that's going to be something that you're going to want to drive into the other book of what, like, you know, what are people really tuned into, like, the characters, the settings, like what was making this book so much fun? And it's definitely the play between Maggie and Joe, because I could just picture this, these two characters, like, really, you don't know what we're doing here? Like, you really can't get this.
And that is the basis of a great series, because it's all about character, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I know a lot of people, some people love the international settings and some people don't like the international setting. So I can't rely on readers to give me a roadmap as to where it goes. But I think everybody is pretty much identifying with either Joe or Maggie.
Right. Well, just the conflict between the two, the way the two are such different people, and the way, you know, Joe, you feel like never left town, like she's been here her whole life. And this other woman traveled the world and has so much to offer her, and has seen negotiating, has seen all these kinds of things that are going to happen. And I think it was a fun power play to watch the two of them going back up against each other right till the end. Like, she shows up at the house and like, oh, no, again with these people, what are they doing? You know?
But they're both so capable. They just have different spheres of capability. And that's what I love about that.
Okay, you can pull up, but guys, we're not giving everything away really early. There's that body at the end of the driveway. Like, seriously, folks, like, do you know this person? You know, and all of a sudden alarm bells go off. And usually you see maybe a dead person right in your driveway, but you don't realize it's got something international implications. You're just not thinking that. You're thinking somebody was walking in the wrong place at the wrong time. Not this, you know? And what did they say? It's like the two shots in the head is called what?
A double tap.
But yeah, there's a double tap. Double tap is a giveaway that something really bad happened. And there's torture involved. And you just sit there and say, that doesn't happen in anybody's driveway, just anybody's driveway, you know? And she's sitting there like, whoa, here we're going to Maine. Are you kidding me? You know?
Well, I think what really throws Joe is Maggie's calmness about the whole thing. She doesn't act like a hysterical old lady, right? She's just asking questions and she's very calm about it. And Joe's going, what is it with this woman?
Oh, well, let's look at the
phone. And then, of course, her security system with the 16 cameras.
It's so great because the dichotomy between the two, but it's, and also the way they have these fabulous meals that are based on where they've been. They're a crowd, and all this poor woman, Joe, is on the outside, and they're just walks in the room and they look like, yes, do you need our help? Do you need our help on what was going on right now? Because we can be there for you, you know? Well, we won't tell you much. We'll just solve it for you. Nothing else. Yeah. Okay, Tess, this was just a great book. Once again, I'm telling you, folks, this is her best. And I really give this super high praise. I sat down and started reading this and just could not stop. And I folded down some pages that went back to, because the settings, everything else is just so well done. So congratulations. I can't wait to see what you do next.
Well, thank you. And it's so good to know I'm not over the hill yet.
Absolutely not. Look at this. She's even got her hair touched to like match the cover of the book, folks. This woman is not over the hill at all, you know? Such a pleasure seeing you again. And I'm looking forward to doing this again. What is it? April 2025, we'll be doing this again?
Yes.
I'll be checking again then. So thanks for joining us. And to our readers, look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Remember, you can find us on the Book Report Network on YouTube, and you can find us on podcasts as Book Reporter Talks To as well. Thank you so much, everyone. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from The Spy Coast by Tess Gerritsen, narrated by Hillary Huber and Brittany Presley, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Brilliance Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. This show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from The Spy Coast by Tess Gerritsen, narrated by Hillary Huber and Brittany Presley, courtesy of Brilliance Audio.
She used to be the golden girl. How things have changed, she thought, staring in the mirror. Her hair, once artfully streaked with sun-kissed highlights, was now what could only be described as dead mouse brown. It was the most unobtrusive shade of hair color she could find on the shelves at the Monoprix, where she'd gone shopping after a neighbor mentioned that a man had been asking about her. That was the first clue that something might be amiss, that someone was asking about her. Although, there could have been a completely innocent explanation. He might have been an admirer, or a man trying to make a delivery. But she did not want to be caught unprepared, so she'd headed across town to a Monoprix in the 3rd arrondissement, a neighborhood where no one knew her, and she'd bought hair color and eyeglasses. These were items she should always have kept on hand, but over the years, she'd grown complacent, careless. She studied herself as a brunette and decided that the new hair color was not enough. She picked up scissors and began to cut, ravaging her 300-euro hairstyle by L'Atelier Blanc. Every snip of the scissors was like another slash to the fabric of her new life, a life she'd so carefully curated. As handful after handful of freshly cut hair slithered onto the bathroom tiles, she kept snipping, her regret soon turning to rage. Everything she'd planned, everything she'd risked, was now all for nothing. But that was the way of the world. No matter how clever you think you are, there was always someone cleverer. And that was her mistake, not considering the possibility that she could be outsmarted. For too many years, she had been the smartest person in the room, the one who was always two steps ahead and could outmaneuver anyone else on the team. The secret to success was to not let the rules get in your way, an approach that others didn't always appreciate. Yes, mistakes were occasionally made. Yes, blood was sometimes unnecessarily spilled. She'd made enemies along the way, and some of her colleagues now despised her. But thanks to her efforts, the mission was always accomplished. That's what had made her the golden girl. Until now. Snip. She studied her reflection, this time with a cool and critical eye. In the 10 minutes it had taken her to chop off her prized locks, she had gone through all the stages of grief for her lost life. Denial, anger, depression. Now she'd reached the stage of acceptance, and she was ready to move on, to shed the carcass of the old Diana and breathe into existence a new Diana. No longer the golden girl, but someone seasoned by experience into tempered steel. She would survive this, too. She swept all her fallen hair into a trash bag and threw in the empty box of hair dye as well. She had no time to sterilize the place, so she'd leave behind traces galore of her presence here. But that could not be helped. She only hoped that the Paris police would rely on their typical sexist instincts to assume that the woman who'd lived in this apartment, the woman who was now missing, had been abducted. A victim, not a perpetrator. She put on glasses and tousled her newly cropped hair into a messy swirl. It was merely a light disguise, but it should be enough to throw off any neighbors she might encounter on the way out. She tied off the trash bag and carried it out of the bathroom and into the bedroom, where she retrieved her go bag. What a shame she'd have to abandon all her beautiful shoes and dresses. But she needed to travel light, and leaving behind a closet full of designer fashions would make her disappearance look all the more involuntary. So would leaving behind the art she'd collected over the years, after her bank accounts had bloomed. The antique Chinese vases, the Chagall painting, the 2,000-year-old Roman bust. She'd miss them all, but sacrifices had to be made if she was to survive. Carrying her go bag and the trash bag with the hair clippings, she walked out of her bedroom and into the living room. There she gave another sigh of regret. Unsightly blood spatters stained her leather sofa and arced across the wall where the Chagall hung, like an abstract extension of the painting itself. Crumpled beneath the Chagall was the source of that blood. The man had been the first attacker through her door, so he was also the first one she'd dispatched. He was just your typical manly man, whose hours at the gym had paid off in bulging biceps, but not in brains.